Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a Scholarly Perspectives episode with Dr. Rüdiger Rupp. I'm David.
And I'm Marla, and today we will be discussing the key points of the 2019 ISN CSCI examination, non-SCI taxonomy, and the INSCI training. This topic was submitted by Asia's International Standards Committee. Our guest today is Dr. Rudy Rupp. Dr. Rupp is a professor and doctor of engineering. He studied his electrical engineering with focus on biomedical engineering at the Technical University of Karlsruhe, Germany. He received his diploma and his doctoral degree from the Technical University of Karlsruhe, Germany in 1994 and 2008, respectively. He finalized his habilitation in 2018 in experimental neurology at the Medical Faculty of Heidelberg University in Heidelberg, Germany. Since 2021, he has held a professorship for assistive neurotechnology at Heidelberg University. Since 1996, he has been with the Spinal Cord Injury Center of Heidelberg University Hospital, where he founded a research group and holds the position as the head of section experimental neurorehabilitation. He has a variety of research interests in the field of rehabilitation engineering for people living with spinal cord injury. These include neuroprosthetics, man-machine interfaces, gait analysis, robotic devices for locomotion therapy, and software projects for standardized documentation of rehabilitation outcome. He is author of more than 400 journal, book chapter, textbook, and conference publications. He has been awarded several times for his work and is a member of several engineering and spinal cord societies such as IEEE, ISCOS, and ASIA. He is a member of the Board of Directors of ASIA and the German SCI Foundation and President-elect of the German SCI Society. Since 2017, he has served as chair of Asia's International Standards Committee, responsible for review and update of the ISN CSCI exam. Welcome, Dr. Rupp.
Thank you very much for the nice introduction, Marla. I'm really proud to be here and glad to be here and talk about maybe then a little bit more about our INSCI stuff. So that makes it easier, not only saying, the Asia exam. So that's the words that we are typically using. Yes.
Well, we're so excited to have you here, and we thought we'd start off by just kind of getting a sense for what drew the International Standards Committee to determine that changes within the INSCI exam were necessary in 2019.
So I mean, the INSCI exam is the standard exam that we have in our field. I mean, everyone knows that. It is applied internationally in every SCI center, and it classifies the level of the lesion and the severity of the lesion. And since it is has evolved with it into a standard over the last 30 years, it is heavily used then also in large databases and large data collections, like the US registry, Canadian registry, and also we in Europe have a registry where we are collecting a lot of data. And it was quite interesting that we saw that there are, let's call it a few cases, and we have now numbers on that. It's about 5 to 10% of cases which show a very unusual pattern then of the lesion. And we asked ourselves, is this really then a lesion that is only related to the spinal cord injury, or is there something additional? And we really went back then to the medical records. And we found, there seems to be a non-SCI condition that overlays actually then the spinal cord injury. And that was the reason why we said, okay, we need to find a way how to precisely document this. That was the first thing. And that led us to the introduction then of this non-SCI taxonomy, which was one of the major changes then of the 2019 revision. And one thing I also want to make clear here, even if it is called a standard, the standard changes. I mean, it's not perfect, you know. At some point in time, you need to make small adaptations. We are super conservative about this, but at some part, you need to adjust things. And the non-SCI taxonomy was something that we clearly identified there is a need for it. That was the first. And the second thing was we changed the definition, but the the applicability then of the zone of the partial preservation. And the reason for this is this was actually brought by patients to us. We emphasized so often, don't focus too much on the AIS, which is, I mean, a sixth grade scale where 134 parameters are actually then compressed to. We are always emphasizing use all the parameters you have. And the bad thing about this, the zone of partial preservation, it was only defined in people with a complete spinal cord injury. So meaning no motor and sensory function in the lowest sacral segments. And that bothered us. Because, I mean, as a patient, you might have residual functions left, and you know that. However, in your sheet that you receive, it is said, well, that your zone of partial preservation is not defined. You don't want to hear about this, you know? And that was one of the reasons why we said, okay, we need to change actually then the applicability then of the zone of partial preservation also to incomplete patients, mostly motor incomplete patients. And we found out that by changing this, the zone of the applicability, the definition, we found out that the zone of partial preservation has a way better predictive value. So if there are functions then preserved below the level of the injury, we know now from these large databases that we have that we can have a better prediction in the end of maybe then recovery. And that was the rationale why we introduced these two major changes. Let's call it like this.
Yeah, if we come back to zone of partial preservation and zoom in a little bit right now on the non-SCI, it's so great to be talking to you because can explain the rationale behind why some of these things were implemented. So from the outside, I might look at the non-SCI and think that the intention was to apply this INSCI to a non-spinal cord injury diagnosis. And it sounds like that wasn't the case.
That wasn't really the case. So it's still, I mean, INSCI is an exam that should only be applied then to people with spinal cord injury. However, there are some cases, and let's give me a concrete example. You have a person with a motorcycle accident, which has a thoracic lesion, but also then a plexus brachialis lesion then on the upper extremities. The plexus brachialis lesion is not related to the SCI directly because this person has not a tetraplegia, still has impairments then on the upper extremity. And how to document then this correctly. So in 2003, there was an initiative then in the standards where there was a 5-star introduced as a motor grade. And so this 5-star was exactly then used for such a case, meaning, yes, there is a paralysis then of the upper extremity, mostly then unilateral on one side. And then you grade the scores actually as 5-star and say, okay, you assume that these scores are normal then for classification. However, the problem is, I mean, there might also be, in particular in this case, sensory impairments, how to deal with them, first. And second, and this is really something I also want to emphasize, it is the use of the comments box. You know, this white spot actually then on the worksheet and of the INSCI worksheet that is hardly used. I have seen so many worksheets where there were comments all over the place, but the only space actually that was left empty was the comments box. And so, I mean, if people don't document what was the real examination score in the comments box, this information gets lost. And so we decided, okay, first, we should document really then the results that we see, so the motor grades and the sensory grades, and we should offer then an examiner a possibility to put in and to include and integrate clinical judgment. And so that's the reason why we introduced this non-SCI taxonomy, which is basically a star. So you examine a patient, you document the scars, the scores on the worksheet, and then you star actually then the score. And then you write in the comments box how these stars should be treated for classification. Let me return to the example that I gave with the peripheral nerve injury then on the upper extremity and the thoracic lesion. So in this case, an examiner would score all the scores in the upper extremity, then with a star, and write in the comments box The STAR test scores should be treated as normal for classification. And by this, the neurological level actually then is the thoracic lesion, which we all actually then would expect. And also then the severity of the lesion then is based on the scores below the thoracic neurological level of injury and not the cervical lesion, which is not a spinal cord injury, but a peripheral a nerve lesion. There are other examples. How are these non-SAI conditions caused by? Swollen limbs, we often see that in exams. We have results then from prior exams, which we want to integrate. We have tendon transfers. We have now recently then published then a workbook where we on the committee then agreed on a consensus that we are also able then to classify people then who have a tendon transfer if we know actually then the examination results before. And so this is a mighty tool to really standardize and include clinical judgment actually then in the exam. And where it is really important is what we often hear from clinical trials is that they first do not include then people then into these clinical trials because simply they are not classifiable then by the INSCI exam. That's the first thing. And the second thing that might happen is that over the course of the study participation, there might be a non-SAI condition arising where people actually then cannot be classified anymore. And then they are dropping out of a study simply because they cannot be classified accordingly and correctly. And that this is something that we wanted to prevent. And that's the basic rationale then of this non-SAI taxonomy.
So for all the research and medical trainees out there, just make sure to write something in that open box so that if Dr. Rupp sees your INSCI exam paper, he knows that you're paying attention.
So we are always emphasizing then in trainings that everything that is unusual during the exam should be noted down really then in the comments box. And in the non-SAI taxonomy, it's the reason. So in this case, in the case that I actually mentioned, it is write down, okay, the stars are related, well, the stars are there, the non-SAI condition is the brachial plexus lesion, and how then the stars are classified. And I think the comments box is really something like, a place where people are really reluctant to write something in, and this is wrong. So I think the more that is documented, the more that is known about the problems that you also encountered during the exam, helps a subsequent examiner then really then to interpret actually then the results. And I think that there is too less use than of the comments box. And be brave enough and write something in there. It's exact. If you see the different worksheets over the years, this is the only place on the worksheet which actually did not change size. And that's the reason because we want you to write something in there.
I think that's a really good segue into kind of the training piece of this. You all published a paper regarding the training, regarding the INSCI calculators. And do you have any tips out there? You know, a lot of our listeners are heads of their, you know, SCI research committees or things like that and training a lot of people up and coming in SCI. Do you have any recommendations for how to go about training, some pitfalls, and then maybe talk a little bit about the INSCI calculators and how they can be used and how they shouldn't be used.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's an interesting or an important topic then about trainings. So we in Heidelberg are the center that are doing the trainings then for this European network. And the reason why we did that was once I was the guy actually who entered the data in a database, and once I got two worksheets, which one has been done then on the intensive care unit and the second one on the normal ward, and in between there was one day. And I looked at these sheets and I said, oh, there are miracles going on then simply by moving from the intensive care unit to the normal ward. Of course, there were no miracles. It was simply that people had a very different understanding of how to perform this exam. So I think the first thing is we really need to have the same understanding about how to perform the exam. And that's really that's the most important part. Classification, this is something where you can at least then in the end and can do some quality checks and maybe then also some adjustments. But the exam results are super, super important. We have so InStep, so the online training tool, then I think it's a very good starting point, really, then to get familiar with the, I would say, specifics of the exam. I talk a lot of to physical therapists and physiotherapists, and they learn actually the exam slightly different. And so you need to be aware about really then the specifics of the exam, simply that we all get to the same results. That's super, super important. And that's the first thing. InStep is a good source of, I think, information. We have been very keen on publishing a lot of information over the last few years, which is the motor exam guide, a sensory exam guide. And all the publications that we published are open access. And the reason for that is because this information needs to be accessible, in particular for trainees and for residents. And so I think this is also a very good source of information. We have regularly then at the Asia meeting, we have workshops where we simply pinpoint then to the pitfalls in the exam. I mean, it's not a whole training course. I mean, this is just a 1-hour workshop, but at least we can sensitize then people and say, guys, be careful at this segment. Be careful how you do the exam. Be careful that the patient need to be concentrated and all that stuff. I think that's really, really important. And of course, the best thing is you participate in training. This does not mean to be an official Asia training, but simply look over the shoulders of someone actually who is experienced and doing this exam since a lot of years. However, and that's also an experience that we made in our training courses, the guys who have done this over 20 years and have not actually then be aware that there are some revisions of the INSCI standard, that might not be the ideal person actually to look over their shoulders. So they should have been actually been aware of the recent of the most recent changes. That's the exam part. And really, I think exam is something super important, and you learn this by practicing it, by doing it on a regular basis. When we have our trainings, I always say farewell then to the participants by saying, guys, do this exam, because if you don't do it for 4 weeks, you have forgotten everything. So practicing, doing it on a regular basis. For the classification part, I mean, what I often hear from people is that this classification is not super intuitive. So it's difficult, and you have to learn actually the rules. I'm wondering, because I mean, we are all used to learn rules then also for other exams, but people are always complaining about this in the INSCI exam. I mean, you have to know what you're doing, and you have to learn the rules. And there is also a lot of material. It starts with the backside of the worksheet. Yes, there is a backside. So please be aware, because there is a lot of information already given there. Still, I mean, there are some parameters which are really hard to classify. And this is the Asia Impairment Scale. The Asia Impairment Scale, in particular, the distinction between AISB and C, this is really somehow complicated. And that was one of the reasons why we said, okay, maybe we can at least then help people with these calculators. I mean, this is an electronic implementation then of the rules. The issue with the calculators is, I think it's a good training tool. Really then to have some sort of a self-check of your own skills and results and classification skills. This has been validated. At least there were two calculators out there that have been validated then by people with a lot of experience. However, and how it comes to however, these calculators are not perfect. Calculators cannot read comments boxes. I mean, maybe in the next 10 years we have AI tools that are able to extract the relevant information, but at the moment they are really stupid. They are simply implementing really the standard rules, and so if there is anything somehow unusual, to the exam, and to be honest, the most challenging cases are not the ones that we think of when we are compiling all these challenging cases. Worksheets, the most challenging cases are the real patients then to exam, because so many things can happen and so many things are so complicated. And here the calculators come to their limit. So don't trust actually then the calculators as being always right. This is not true. However, and this is also, I think, something important, all the programmers of these calculators then are reachable. So there are email addresses out there. And if you think that there is a there is something wrong with the calculator, simply write the programming team. And we are really responding. So we are not sitting, we are not an AI, so we are real persons. And I think that's also important because there people can learn from us, but we are also we can also learn what really people need. And maybe there is this single case, and there are cases where the two calculators come up with different results. And this also helps us then in the committee really then to see, oh, maybe there is a lack of definition, maybe there is a lack of clarity how to deal with such cases. And this helps us actually then. So be careful with the calculators. They are good tools in those, I would say, typical cases, but be careful, not every result that they provide you is correct.
That's great on classification. If we can return though to the exam itself quickly, you gave this quick anecdote about a physical therapist might be trained to perform the exam differently. But if we take maybe three different examples that are going to be common to our professional audience, maybe a neurosurgeon in a trauma context and the person can't quite participate the same, a physiatrist, an inpatient, and a PT, an outpatient, how would you expect the exam to be done a little bit differently there?
Yeah, so I mean, we are well aware that in particular, a neurosurgeon in a trauma center where people don't have actually then really time then to do the exam properly. I mean, we see elderly patients nowadays. We see more incomplete patients, and then the exam really can take quite a long time. So if you do it really thoroughly, in particular the pinprick exam, so the sensory part is really the time-consuming one. That can last up to an hour. I mean, there is not the time simply then for research then we didn't to do this kind of an exam. And so, and we are aware of that. And that was one of the reasons why we recently then released the e-INSCI exam, so the expedited exam, which is an exam that actually provides the shortest way then towards the NLI and the AIS, which we believe are the most important parameters then of the INSCI exam, and so we give clear guidance here. However, and this is also something that I really want to emphasize is someone needs to be familiar with the full INSCI exam in order to do the e-INSCI properly. That's the first thing, and the second thing is, I mean, it's a shortcut exam, so you might miss actually then some parts then of the full exam. So a full exam afterwards at some point in time is absolutely necessary. And I think this should be done by someone who is at least experienced then with a manual muscle exam first. On the other hand, I mean, we all know the sensory exam part with the anorectal exam. So I would not pick one profession and say a physiotherapist should do everything, and I would not say a physician or PNMR specialist should actually then do the exam. I mean, a training is necessary then for everyone, and I believe people should know what they do, and should be at least then be aware that how to perform the exam correctly. And I don't want to pick one profession and say this person actually then is ideal. Look, I'm an engineer. I'm at least, and when my boss tells me, okay, you have to do the INSCI exam, then I'm at least allowed to do it, and I do it, you know. So I mean, it's not a magic thing. You can learn about it. Nevertheless, you need to be aware about the specifics. It's not a brake test when you test for muscle force and muscle strength. So it's somehow a little bit different than according to the manual muscle test and physiotherapists that used to do.
I think I also just want to mention here, since we had hopped onto the training, that Asia has some resources for training for clinicians. The INSTEP on Asia's website is available. And then the other thing that the International Standards Committee has put out is this handout for patients that helps make the exam more accessible for patients. And we were talking offline about how it's important to explain to patients why the examination is important and what they actually are doing with the information. Would you mind talking a little bit about the handout and how you all kind of created it and how you may think it may be useful for clinicians and researchers?
Well, Mala, thank you for raising this point. I mean, the INSCI exam then is an important exam, then in particular in the early phase, because it is somehow, I know that there are many complaints about this, but it is, of course, then the scale and the tool that we have then in at least in order to do some sort of prognosis. And I think this is really an important exam. However, I mean, there are some, I would say, delicate parts then of the exam, which is the anorectal exam. And if people are not really then informed about this before, I mean, people are afraid of that or are scary about it. And I mean, you really need to be concentrated because, you know, we are not examining robots. I mean, we are examining human beings, and we are relying then actually then on the cooperation of those patients, because they have to reliably actually then tell us, is this sharp? Does it feel sharp? Do you feel actually then this sensation? And I mean, people need to be cooperative. And I think it's really important then that they have a proper information before we do this examination. I mean, so, and that was the reason why we said, okay, we should have a one pager. It's a trifold in the end, and this brochure that we developed, simply informing a patient about how the exam is being done and what do we get out of it. One important information is a neurological level of injury is not the same as a bony level. Almost everyone actually knows the bony level, but this might not, in particular, if you go to more caudal lesions, this might not be actually then the same, but people don't really then not often understand it. What I think is also important, and this is most frustrating to patients, if you say they have a complete lesion. And so I think that it's also necessary really then to for people to understand, what does this actually mean? It does mean that there is no motor and sensory function in the lowest sacral segments. But of course, there can be preserved functions then actually then above this and below the neurological level of injury. And I think this also needs to be clearly communicated. What does this actually mean, this complete classification? And I think these are all components. And one problem that we often see, I mean, in clinical practice, we all know this, is that patients, and in particular then the relatives, are highly overinterpreting this Asia impairment scale, which I think is really dangerous. I mean, yes, we know there is some, I would say, well, prognostic value in this AIS. So if you have an initial exam and you are complete, we know that about 75% probability that after 1 year you will stay complete. But nevertheless, in the stone of partial preservation, there can be marvelous things going on. And this has to be actually then clearly communicated. And that was the reason why we set up this flyer then really then in lay language. We sent this out, you know, being a committee member, I would say we have somehow a little bit of a bias, because of course we know all the terminology and we don't understand why people don't understand actually all this stuff that we are talking about, the 12 members of the committee. And so we sent this out then to user organizations people with lived experience and ask for their feedback. And they raised interesting questions. And all this actually then, I think we changed this flyer two or three times based on the feedback that we get from people with lived experience, because people simply did not understand what you're talking about here. And can you phrase this differently? For us, it was really an experience to come up with something like that. But I think it's necessary, you know? I mean, it's not only about professionals, it's also about people that actually that get exempt and need to align their expectations then based on the results that we get out of the exam. And it's an important exam. It's still an important exam then also for prognosis.
That's great, Dr. Rupp. This is another one in a beat that we have here on the podcast about this exam, either explicit episodes like previously with Dr. Kirschblum or other episodes like the recent non-traumatic where these topics come up. So thank you so much for just giving us the deep dive on these recent changes and pointing our professional listeners to some of the training education resources you have.
David, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity then to talk a little bit more about the work that is done in the committee. It's not only me. So I'm just representing actually the committee, and I'm really proud to work together with such brilliant minds. I mean, it's really wonderful to work together with these people then and moving then INSCI forward.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The paper discussed in this episode was chosen based on the recommendation of Asia's International Standards Committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your production host David McMillan, and Marla Petrillo, our editor and production assistant, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at sciperspectivespodcast@gmail.com.